the Western Question. First order of business is to review and approve the agenda. Can I get a motion to do that?
So moved.
Any discussion? Sandy, because Scott is telephonically connected, we need to do this by roll call vote.
Okay, Bob Anderson?
Yes.
Jim Cox?
Yes.
Dave Hartwell?
Yes.
Heather Ingridson?
Yes.
Jane Kingston?
Yes.
Sue Olson?
Yes.
Scott Rawl?
Yes.
Elizabeth Wilkins? Is she on yet?
She's not on yet.
Okay. No.
All right. Agenda is approved. Next is the minutes from our last meeting. Can I get a motion to approve the minutes from our last meeting?
So moved.
Is there any discussion? Sandy, call the roll, please.
Bob Anderson?
Yes.
Jim Cox?
Yes.
David Hartwell?
Yep.
Senator Ingridson?
Yes.
Jane Kingston?
Yes.
Sue Olson?
Yes.
Scott Rawl?
Yes.
Great. Thank you all. Any conflicts of interest that haven't been previously disclosed and are on record? Not seeing any. Executive Director's report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to report that the Outdoor Heritage Fund bill has been introduced in the House. It was an interim introduction. We have an early hearing. We're trying to move it as quickly as possible. The hearing is 9 a.m. November 12th in the Environment, Natural Resources, and Agricultural Finance Committee. That's Gene Wagenius' committee. Sponsors of the bill so far are Hanson, McNamara, and Lilly, and thank them for signing and co-sponsoring the bill. The lead author is Hanson, as you know. We're in contact with Tom Saxon's office to make sure he picks it up from the majority leader's office and gets it introduced as quickly as possible. There's no interim introduction in the Senate. DNR roundtable session on the Outdoor Heritage Fund was conducted last Friday, and there was an additional discussion on Saturday. Chair Hartwell and Senator Ingebretson presented to a group of 300 or 400, it's a large group, about the progress on the Outdoor Heritage Fund projects and appropriations and where the money had gone and that sort of thing, fielded questions. We learned that the working group, which is a group of people who are interested in the way the Outdoor Heritage Fund is used, are putting together a summertime get together to discuss progress and where we should be going in the future. We'll be hearing more about that. Heather, you were there. Is there anything else that we ought to bring up to the members about this particular? David, maybe you or Bill might want to say something.
No, I think I can't say a lot. There was a question about the AIS and how that proposal came through, which I attempted to answer as best I could. I'm not sure I satisfied those that felt it should have stayed in its original form, but I gave them a clear answer of what we did. I think that was the question that probably was somewhat touchy, I guess you could say. Otherwise, it was fine. I didn't have any negative feedback. I talked to the guy that asked me the question afterwards, and he said he just disagreed.
Okay. Staffing update. We filled the assistant director position. Heather took that position about 3 weeks ago. That opens up the position that Heather was in, which we're in the process of working with LCC and the advertising and filling that, and we'll see what happens at that point in time. Heather, could you report on the calendar date change issue?
Yeah, this came to me 2 days ago, I think, a request from the small work leader working on the cost of funding request to alter the fall dates, essentially to push everything back about 1 week. Sandy and I yesterday went through the calendar, saw that the first 2 dates in question in September and in November were not a problem in terms of moving the calendar back with 1 week. The problematic date is in December. If we move that date from the 11th back to the 18th, we run into Jewish holidays. It also presents a logistical problem for staff in trying to get the bill into the revisor's office through all of the necessary steps and checks to get it to that point and then to leadership by January 15th. So from staff's perspective, we don't recommend that a change in that December date. Of course, the change in all the dates is dependent upon members' ability to alter the calendars.
And I might add, the change in the date is also dependent upon adopting the recommendation of the group that's been working on the call that we do a double scoring, one scoring before hearing and another scoring after hearing. So we'll get into this later, but we wanted to let you know that we're doing things in this agenda today that are going to affect the calendar, may affect the calendar. So if we get to that point, take note, please.
Can we get a poll from people as to whether that's even possible, given their schedule? I can tell you that September I won't be here. I've already made commitments for the following week, and I suspect others may have some of the same issues. You can do it without me, but...
Are we looking at this calendar now, or is there another calendar?
Well, what there are
some other dates that have been changed.
No, they're talking about September, I guess, moving from the 9th to the 16th.
From the 22nd to the 27th.
These are meetings of hours or meetings of deadlines?
The 22nd is a deadline that would move. And October is meetings.
But the group in September, the 9th, that would move to the 16th?
That one doesn't move.
No.
That's the hearing is 11th.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
You know, the group that was working on the call certainly has brought forth this item for general conversation by the council as to whether there's going to be a pre-score and a post-score after the hearings are done. We're spending some time trying to arrange a schedule. I was on that group that is bringing that proposal to the council for discussion. I'm not necessarily sure that actual event or activity is going to take place. Should we get to that part of our meeting and determine whether that event actually takes place before we determine whether we need to approve or get all the other schedules taking place? I, for one, on that group that was working on the call, I was aware of the desire for a pre-score and then a post-hearing score. And I, as a member, said yes, well, the council should talk about that. I'm not sure that that's going to come to fruition or not. Should we delay our schedule conversation until we determine whether that activity is actually going to take place or not?
That's fine. I just thought that was coming forth as a proposal, and I think of a schedule change has some consequences. I know for me, and I suspect for others.
It's certainly coming forth as a proposal, but it is not coming forth as a unanimous proposal from the group that worked on the call.
Okay.
That's correct. And I think that, Mr. Chair, all I wanted to do was to make sure people understood that we had to address this and we changed our process. So, having said that,
okay. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'm understanding now. Who's on that committee that was looking into this? I'm sorry, I apologize.
It's not a committee; it's a small working group, right. And people have been working on it: Sue Olson, Scott Rawl, and Jane Casey.
Okay. So the decision's not going to be made today on the schedule change. Is that fair to say?
Or? We will discuss it.
Okay.
Later.
Okay.
So, in your package, you have the transmittal letter on the bill, and the bill as it went to the governor is more specifically the majority leader and the speaker. So I wanted you all to have a copy of that. Is there anything else we've already covered? We have expense report, or expense reimbursement changes. Sandy, could you quickly go through what the changes are?
Yeah, just quickly, they increased your limits for meals. So if you look on the back of your expense form, you got an extra buck or so.
So, eat high on the hog.
Salmon, right?
Famous Dave's?
Old salmon.
Old salmon. Yeah. Old salmon.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
All right. Eat high on the hog.
Next is an update from the executive committee with regard to discussion of indirect and coverage of indirect. Jane, do you want to handle this since you made the motion?
I made the motion, and it's similar to what Scott was describing regarding possible changes in the procedure for scoring. This is really up for debate. The whole issue of direct service support services, I'm just going to call it support services because there's so much back and forth over indirect and direct support services. And there have been a lot of, I've gotten feedback from some applicants since our meeting a week ago. I'm not sure that the motion that I made, which you can see in front of you, is in the best interest of our process. But I can describe it in that we looked at the lists of eligible, ineligible, and prohibited expenses as listed by LCCMR. We also looked at ineligible expenses as listed in the CPL program, which is a division of the Outdoor Heritage Fund. But the work that's done subject to the recommendations that we make is so varied and the groups are so varied that I have serious doubts that we can make any kind of a blanket recommendation that's a one-size-fits-all. What I was willing to do at the last meeting was make a recommendation that we adopt simply the prohibited activities that are listed by LCCMR. Do we have a list of those? Are they attached? If you look at the second page in, the third page in, it's the lower right-hand corner that says prohibited expenses. But even those can be problematic. For instance, if a conservation group purchases property, which they can do because they're usually more flexible than the DNR and they can get deals done quicker, if they buy it with the intent that the DNR is going to subsequently buy it, they're saddled with property taxes per year, for instance. And that's not necessarily a fair deal. So I'm very torn as to whether we should have any listed prohibitions or ineligibility. Certainly not. I think that the DNR reviews all of the projects with all of the applicants, and they have to go through the process of determining what the law says, which the law says it must be direct and necessary. And I just keep going back. At this point in time, I feel that there are so many permutations and combinations of work that's done and details to projects or programs that I don't feel comfortable in making any blanket recommendation at all at this stage.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah?
I would volunteer to work on a working group over the next few months to try to better clarify what our desires are and what some possible solutions might be if the group or the council as a whole would agree that that might be a way to move forward on how we might deal with these direct support services, you know, over time.
Danny?
Can I just ask somebody to give me an answer, Mr. Chair? Sorry, the road is closed. Can I ask somebody to give me an example of where they don't understand if it's allowable or not allowable? And I'll just use a DNR as an example, because the NGOs can decide to eat some overhead or some expenses that the DNR, I would argue, statutorily doesn't have the flexibility to do. We had the auditor, once the auditor come in, lay out quite clearly the guidelines that are supposed to be followed by these folks. And I'm not sure I understand where the problem is.
You know, Chair, I'll give you two classic examples. I think both were used by the auditor. One is the commissioner's salary. This is a cost and expense that's going to be incurred whether or not there's an outdoor heritage fund, whether or not there's an outdoor heritage fund program. And so should you allocate commissioner's salaries into the calculation of support services? Another one that the OLA brought up was rent. DNR, DNR example, DNR has a 3-year, 5-year lease on their property. I'm not sure exactly what the extent of it is, but it's outside the boundaries of basically our appropriation. They've committed to it whether they get outdoor heritage fund or not. Should we, as a fund, pay for that rent cost that they're going to have whether or not we have a project with them or not? Those are two examples that the OLA brought up, and he actually was looking for a little direction on how to audit those kinds of expenses. Other staff may have other examples, but those are the classics that I would think of.
Well, Mr. Chair,
DNR already said they're not going to include upper management. I thought that was
no, but resolved. He asked for examples, and that's an example.
But that's been resolved.
With DNR, but
with
not
DNR.
With other groups.
Correct.
And I might point out, DNR, in testimony for the executive committee, said they were considering and thought about it.
Any?
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Becker, I appreciate those examples. And in both cases, I think the legislative auditor told us how they're supposed to deal with rent. They can't charge us for space that they would be renting if the project didn't exist. So in other words, if they have a 5-year lease in this space where the employee that's working on our project, that space has to be rented, no matter what, they can't charge us. But if they have to keep some space that they can't let go back to the building owner because they need it for these folks, then that would be an allowable case. In other words, if they have an option to not rent that, they can't charge us for that space. But if they have to rent space to put our people in, then it's allowable. And I thought we had his testimony to kind of give those guidelines. Now, that is the area that can be gray, but I think we've laid out a plan that works. In regards to the commissioner and deputy commissioner salaries, I would argue that's their decision not to keep track of their time. If they're working on a project of ours, I believe it should be allocated to whatever project, because if it's not charged to a LaSalle example project, then somebody else is paying for it, and I'm not sure that that's correct either. Now, I get where they've decided not to include that, and that probably makes it a lot easier for everybody involved, and I can agree with that part of it. I think if I remember the deputy commissioner on when I sat in on the executive committee, he said they don't do the commissioner's staff, so that group of people there, they don't do, and that's good for us as a LaSalle Sam's, but if you were somebody in the Game and Fish Fund Oversight Committee arguing that we know Deputy Commissioner Shad took a ride down to Marshall and met with a landowner in trying to work out a deal for an acquisition for WMA that Messiah Sam's is paying for, and arguably Game and Fish Funds is paying for part of that, so something else doesn't happen. You could argue that's not fair either. But that can work both ways, so I get that. I just think we have to realize in the case of the DNR, we can't expect them to not charge us for direct expenses on our projects, because if they don't charge us, somebody else is paying for them, and when you're wearing the other shoe, that's not fair either. So I think in the commissioner staff it all evens out, but I get where people, and if an NGO wants to give us a free ride, we need to consider that in the request for proposals. That an NGO can do that. They can say, we're not going to charge you for any of our staff time working on this project. That's great, and we should know that ahead of time so we can say, you know what, let's use them instead of the other
proposals. So what do we do, for example, because I don't necessarily disagree with you, but I'll just pick Minnesota Land Trust. Chris Larson sits there and manages the organization, and they're working on a project that his staff is working on, and their logic could be Chris supervises those people, therefore by being in that position he is providing service for this grant by supervising his people, and we ought to pick up 5% of his salary because he's there. Do we want to open that door to every NGO? Because, you know, I think the question is what's direct, and the attempt was to say, these things aren't direct. These are things that you shouldn't include. Now, the list may be wrong, but the intent was to narrow it so that we didn't have those close calls going forward that we ended up arguing about. Maybe we should do it, maybe we shouldn't. There's been enough lack of clarity about what indirect is that this was an attempt to define what was an allowable indirect and what wasn't.
Mr. Chair, in the case of an NGO that tried to do, I think it's a different argument than Deputy Commissioner Shad or Commissioner Land here, because, and I guess I'm not wearing my legislative hat, but we have an obligation for them to be fair to everybody involved in the process. In the case of an NGO, I think it would be very unfair for them to try to allocate some of their administrative top echelon staff to a project, because we could easily say you are going to be in that position whether you get one of our projects or not. You can't charge us. In the case of an administrator in government, I believe we have an obligation that they fairly allocate it all out. They've decided to draw a line where they're going to use kind of a flat process. I get that, and we win on that. But an NGO, I hope that the auditor has made it pretty clear that it'd be a tough argument for them for building costs and top administration to try and argue. I mean, they better show us the rent they have to go rent space.
What about fundraising funds?
You know, Mr. Chair, I think that a lot of those costs are already incurred by them, and that would be really tough for them to come back to us. I mean,
well, so that's why the list was put together, to try to identify those things. And maybe the list isn't right. The question is, do we want a list at all, or do we want to just do nothing and let the process continue as it is with no limitations and it's open for interpretation? That's really the question in front of the council.
Or we could spend more time on it item by item in a fuller conversation about each one. As Scott brought up.
Yeah, do we want a list or don't we want a list? Kind of is the question. Do we want to prohibit some things or not? And I can go either way. I'm not passionate one way or the other. I'm trying to point out what the complexity is. Because I want to, frankly, I want to end this discussion. I want to get us to the point where we no longer talk about what is indirect and what isn't, and who's charging and who shouldn't, and we've wasted so much time doing that time and time again. I want it resolved so we're done. That's my goal. Jim?
Well, I agree with Scott. I think it needs a little more digging into. But the other thing, though, and Representative McNamara, I mean, the DNR right now is discussing with NGOs processes to for them to recover some of these indirect costs individually. I mean, they put the numbers in their proposals this year. So what's going on? And I guess the question is, you know, who's overseeing that?
Danny?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cox, the one thing I would say, the word indirect is problematic, I think, in itself. I think the cost that an NGO gets reimbursed for need to be directly related to the project. And I think the legislative monitor has laid out some pretty strong guidelines that we can use. And I can give examples on this prohibited list where clearly they would be allowable under a certain situation. Gene gave a couple of really good examples. I think if you create a list different than the guidelines we've gotten from the legislative auditor, the legislative auditor should scare the pants out of most people in how strong they are in making sure that our is done right. And so I think we have really good guidelines. I think if NGOs try to stretch it, they're going to get in trouble. I think what's important is we find out ahead of time if they're willing to give us a different situation than say, like DNR or another NGO. That's great news for us. And some of them do that. Some of them don't do anything. They don't charge any cost for what we would argue is overhead, even though it's directly related to the project. And I think we need to know that ahead of time in our process of evaluating projects to get that.
Okay, and so do you know that now?
No, I don't think, Mr. Chair, Mr. Cox, I don't think we always do know it, and it would be better if we did.
Okay, and so then how will we get to that number?
Well, I think it would be the NGO's responsibility and their proposal coming forward to let us know. I would assume.
But if there's no guidelines, how do they get to that number? They just make it up themselves and say, this is the number, we use our guidelines here, and this is the number we've come up with?
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Cox, I don't agree there's not guidelines. You take what the legislative auditor said, you got right down to where a building works and doesn't work. And if you haven't allocated a timesheet to the project and can show that that person worked on the timesheet, or there's 100 employees and it's the HR person and 7 of the employees work on Lassard Sam, 7% of it's allocated, you need to substantiate what you did or you're not going to get it. You can't prove it's right, then you don't get it. And if in doubt, it's not, you don't get it. I believe that.
Mr. Chair, I think it's also important that Minnesota Management and Budget put together a report on what's chargeable.
I mean, the other confusion with this is our own grants program has a list of what's acceptable and not acceptable, which DNR is administering and the legislative auditor is overseeing. So we've got two standards in how we do business.
I just have a few thoughts about that. I think that the CPL program is so radically different from these huge projects and programs that we do that you can't. It's really apples and oranges. And the organizations that come through and ask for CPL money, they don't have the kind of sophisticated hierarchy often that we're dealing with in these larger amounts. So I don't think you can even use that as a rationale. At first I did, now I don't.
I just point out that there are two standards that we have.
Well, the CPL program is completely different.
It's just very complex.
Yeah.
So everyone gets it. It's very complex. So what's the pleasure of the group? Jim?
Mine is that we take Scott's recommendation and get a working group and just continue to dig through this before we make a decision on something that's worse than what we've already got.
What's your thought?
I think we could do that. I don't know if it's going to be fruitful. I think that we have a process. I think that each organization is unique and each structure is unique, and the DNR has responsibility, an independent section, to evaluate it. Now, we could ask some people in the audience to come and speak on it today if we want to, or we could just move on, or we could continue to talk about it. I think, you know, in the big picture, I think it's not a lot of money, but I think if applicants come forward and declare it as leverage in their application, I think that's a good way to talk about it, and there certainly is guidance on it. I mean, I can look at each of these prohibited expenses and come up with where it would work or where it wouldn't work. Like, if I was on the decision-making committee as to whether a particular project should be granted that money or not, I could talk about it. But in the absence of specific examples, I think it's just too complex.
So the options are to continue the discussion or to go with correct and necessary as defined by the DNR and overseen by the legislative auditor. Those are the two options that I see. So I guess I'd like to get to a point where we have a motion that we approve one way or the other so this thing doesn't continue to have a life forever.
Chair, most of the issues with NGOs, that's where...
I would say it's more visible there, but it's not completely...
And my second question, and look, most of those NGOs probably are going to LCCMR for funds also. So if we had a similar one, which I believe I think would be more consistent for all those groups. Yes, we have some different ones, but those, there's always going to be differences.
I would be against adopting anything at this point, having not had the opportunity to flesh them out. I think that the decision today should either be have a working group or put it to bed.
Mr. Chair, if we have a working group, we need a concise charge.
The only thing that I would want to continue to work on is the prohibited list. And I'd like to make a note in the motion on what you have in front of you. I did not approve ineligible expenses as listed in LCCMR. In our last meeting, I proposed the prohibited expenses. I'd be willing to work on the prohibited expenses only and not go any further up the line than that. And that's a lot. That's A through M. But there's exceptions to almost every one of those, too.
I agree with you. We keep talking about this issue. It keeps coming back. We need to get it resolved. Bob, did you have?
Well, Mr. Chair, I would move the suggested motion on the agenda item 5, that approve the addition of the LCCMR list of ineligible expenses in the fiscal year's 16 call for funding requests.
Okay. We have a motion.
Well, discussion. Once again, the motion was prohibited expenses, not ineligible.
Did you offer an amendment?
I'd offer a friendly amendment to make it prohibited, not ineligible.
Can you live with that?
Yes.
So we have a motion to adopt the motion that was made by the executive committee in the executive committee meeting, changing ineligible to prohibited list from LCCMR. Any discussion?
I'd scratch C from the list for the reason I gave earlier. And I don't feel comfortable adopting any of the other ones without a full discussion on each one.
So you're seeing, you're asking for another vote, aren't you?
I guess so, yeah.
Any other discussion?
Chair?
Yes.
I would state my opposition to that motion. I think that this is a pretty critical element. I'm not sure that we completely understand it to the depth that we should. I would recommend that we do not pass this motion, that we that we do set a target date to finalize this issue, but that date is not today.
Okay. So we have a motion on the table.
Did he disappear?
Are you there, Scott? Scott? Elizabeth, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me all right?
Yep. We're just checking to make sure you're there.
Oh, yeah. I've been listening to this exciting conversation here.
So we do have a motion on the table. Tom, the motion is to adopt the recommendation from the executive committee, or the motion out of the executive committee, changing ineligible to prohibited. We've had... Yes?
Mr. Chair?
Yes?
I'm sorry. My call got cut off.
We noticed.
And so I redialed back in. I just wanted to... I don't know exactly where I got cut off at.
You were done.
Okay. Thank you.
We heard you loud and clear. So we have this motion. I'm going to call for a vote on the motion unless, Bob, you feel differently about it, having heard the discussion. All right. So the motion is to adopt this with the list of prohibited expenses as by the LCCMR. Sandy, will you call the roll?
Okay. Scott Rall.
No.
Elizabeth Wilkins.
I really have difficulty with this one. I think a no is in order for myself.
Bob Anderson.
Yes.
Jim Cox.
No.
Stephen Herbal.
No.
Senator Ingridson.
No.
Jane Kingston.
No.
Representative McNamara.
No.
Sue Olson.
No.
Senator Sapsack.
No.
The noes have it. So let me just ask, what do we want to do? How do we want to resolve it? Do we want to leave it as it is? Do we want a working group to come up with a list? We need to resolve it once and for all.
Mr. Chair, I think I'm in the minority when I say I don't want a working group to work on it, but I think because it sounds like there's a strong interest in having a working group, I would strongly recommend they work with LCCMR, potentially look at the idea of bringing in a few of those members. Commission Member Kingston's brought the attention that the list is deficient. Having served on LCCMR before, they would be, they're a lot like us, they would want to have the list correct. So if we are going to have a working group, which I don't think is necessary, I strongly recommend that it include LCCMR members so you do get a consistent list, because I don't think they would want this list right now after what we've brought to their attention.
So can I just, a show of hands of those that would be interested in a working group versus think we ought to just let this issue die with the language that we currently have about direct and necessary? Be helpful. Who wants a working group? So we got two, Scott and Elizabeth, do you have a desire for a working group, or do you feel more comfortable just leaving the language as is with direct and necessary?
I would serve on that group if the council thought it necessary, but if we have containment of those costs, or at least we feel like we do, then I'm neutral on the issue.
Elizabeth?
I think probably, I believe a working group would be fine. The problem is that I've heard this now at LCCMR as a member and now here. This issue is really hard to resolve. And I wonder if maybe we should, in the request for proposals, have a paragraph set aside where all these types of activities that are on the prohibitive or ineligible list be explained, and and have us be able to go one by one and get a better feeling for NGOs versus DNR and all of these other types of activities, so we can clarify better in our minds as to how each entity is approaching them, and take that into account one by one. I don't know if this makes sense, but that's just a gut feeling I have.
Okay. Bill, you have...
Mr. Chair, out of respect for the chair wanting to get this done, we should have a date certain on this, and I'd be in favor of that.
Okay.
Sure, let's come up with a date today and make it once and forever.
I would like to give one more shot at trying to bring some clarity to this issue. I think just walking away now is really not going to solve any issues. It's going to rear its head again. I'm almost positive of that. So I don't know that we're under that big of a timetable to get this accomplished. I think it would be some value into taking, another shot to bring some clarity to this issue. I would be willing to be on the group with Scott as well.
Heather?
I just want to remind members that we are under a timeline in terms of the release of the RFP. So if this would be included in the RFP for next year, we would need to do it within the next couple of weeks, because our intent is to put the call for funding request out for public comment in the next several weeks. And so we want this piece included in that.
Which, from a timetable standpoint, is almost impossible, because we're not meeting in the next couple of weeks.
But why does it have to be part of that, Heather?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Cox, I would assume we would want it included in the call for funding request, so that when applicants prepare their budgets, we'll have a clear understanding of what is allowable and what is not allowable when they complete the budgets.
Bill? Jim?
Okay, but I mean, they don't have a... I mean, I don't think they have a clear understanding today, at least not everybody. And we can always, they don't have to come up with the budget until they do their presentation. If they're going to do it, they're going to do it anyway.
Mr. Chair, the budget is a part of the request and is done simultaneous with responding to the call for requests. There's a line in the budget for these costs. It's called support services. You have the full authority to inspect that line when people come in front of you. All you have to do is ask them, what have you put into your support services? Give us a list of percentages and things like that. You can take a look at it. I think a working group is fine, but I think we need a clear charge and a deadline. And we do meet on the 13th of February.
But again, the public comment period will be between now and February.
That's true.
So I heard three people talk about the desire for continuing this and everybody else silent. I guess if we're going to take action, somebody needs to make a motion to then take action, and we'll vote on that and see what comes of it. But I can't make the call on behalf of everyone.
Okay, so I'll make a motion that we get a working group together to get up to try to bring some clarity to this by our next meeting in February 12th.
Okay. We have that motion. Discussion?
13th.
Heather, call the roll on the motion, please.
Al Anderson.
Yes.
Jim Cox.
Yes.
David Hartwell.
No.
Senator Eglinton.
Yes.
Jane Kingston.
Yes.
Representative McNamara.
No.
Sue Olson.
No.
Scott Rall.
Yes.
Tom Sexa.
Yes.
Elizabeth Wilkins.
Yes.
So we will convene a working group. I've heard Jim and Scott say they're interested. Who else would be interested in working on that? We have a working group of two to bring back a recommendation. All right. Heather?
What's the date to be brought back?
By February 13th.
So it will not be included?
It will not be included in the call. It will not be included in what we put out shortly after this meeting.
It won't be publicly reviewed.
It won't be publicly reviewed. All right. Let's move on. Accomplishment plans. High priority pre-transaction services. Bill, do you want to say anything about these? Or
I just wanted to remind people that these are accomplishment plans that were brought about as a result of decisions at the last meeting. We assume you have taken a look at them. They've been in the packet. And if you have questions or want staff to pursue any changes in them, let us know. Otherwise, we'll continue to use the accomplishments plan as it's laid out to prepare our testimony and description of what the recommendations are all about. And we'll present these accomplishment plans to the public when questions are asked about how the money works.
And just a reminder, all of the accomplishment plans come back to us for approval once the bill, the final bill is approved and we know the exact amount. So this is sort of a if there's something in here that you take issue with, you think is different than what we approved when we approved these projects, this is the time to bring that up so that we can work with them. Otherwise, it will come back to you for actual approval in June. So were there any questions on the three new accomplishment plans? Okay. Thank you. Accomplishment plan amendment, DNR aquatic habitat. Bill, do you want to lead this off?
Yeah, I would be happy to, and I would direct your attention to the action item memo for agenda item number 7. I'm just informed that the principal from DNR is not here yet. Mr. Wilson, do you want to handle this?
Sure, I can.
Okay. However, we have a pinch hitter. Brian Nervon isn't here. Mr. Wilson will be happy to take over. Basically, what this is an amendment to an accomplishment plan that we as staff felt uncomfortable approving. We felt uncomfortable in approving it because of the significant change in the outputs, the acres affected, the acres restored, and things. In discussing this with the department, it came to our attention that there are some interesting protocols in how they're estimating these things, and we thought you all ought to know. And we may want to do something about it or ask the department to do something about it. So with that, Mr. Wilson.
Thank you. For the record, Grant Wilson, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. I did get a message, just so you know, to Brian and Captain Carlos from our Division of Fish and Wildlife, who hopefully will be coming soon. They certainly have a little bit more detailed information than I, but at least I can get you started with the accomplishment plan amendment and the issue at play. So this is the laws of 13 DNR aquatic habitat phase 5. And the amendment, crux of the amendment, is in dollar value relatively small, but the accomplishment that we're asking to be changed is relatively large. If you turn to the back two pages of your handout, you see a photo overview of the two sites. The second page, which is called Little Minnesota Project Site, that was the original proposed project site. It was going to be in-stream habitat work in the Minnesota River Valley. It was upstream of Big Stone Lake, which you can see more portion of the photo, and was going to act as a walleye spawning habitat draw for the entirety of Big Stone Lake. So when the accomplishment plan was written, they they wrote in the acreage to be accomplished as the stream leading up to the project site between that and Big Stone Lake and all of Big Stone Lake. For reasons that Mr. Nervon can explain, that was later to be found unfeasible, and so the proposed amendment, if you look at which on the page titled Minnesota River Project Site, is downstream now of Big Stone Lake. And the project site is very similar. It's almost an identical project that's going to be done in terms of in-stream habitat work. And so the actual work that's being done is, again, almost identical to what was originally proposed. What this did, though, is brought to our attention the original accomplishment plan used an estimate of the entire acreage of Big Stone Lake as habitat that was going to be impacted. And we've since had discussions about this issue. And we think that there's a question here that is important that we want to bring to your attention, that is a crux of this amendment, is when we report accomplishments, especially for aquatic habitat, there is a question of, do you report at the site level? So, for instance, here, the immediate project site is, you know, around 2 acres of actual space that's going to be physically impacted, but the habitat benefit is much larger because you have a large area of stream that is going to be of the fish populations within that stream are going to be using that habitat, and so we've been talking about this internally, and we're not sure if there are other projects that might be impacted by this question. We don't think there are at the moment. So this is kind of the first one we're bringing to your attention. But that's why the change in accomplishment plan or the accomplishment is so large, is because we feel like it is more accurate and more transparent to report the work that's actually being done on the project site. It does bring up, like I said, the issue of the challenge of reporting at the outcome level, because the actual impact of this habitat is going to be much larger than the 2 acres. It opens up. It's going to be new habitat that's created and used by fish populations upstream up to the dam upstream, and then downstream potentially all the way to the mouth of the Minnesota River. And so we thought it would be a good opportunity to have a chat with you all to see what you think about this. You know, like I said, we haven't finished these conversations internally, but we think this is an important issue to be thinking about. We want to report consistently and transparently, but we also want to give you a good idea of what the true habitat benefits are that are being put out there. So that's the short version and the overview. And I'd stand for any questions about that.
So I think the question that I have is, if you crawl into my mind, at least when I was reviewing this project, I was expecting a fairly significant outcome in terms of acreage based on what the DNR was proposing for a fixed dollar amount. And maybe that was the wrong number, which is what I think I'm hearing you say, but if you want to switch that now for something that's 14% of the affected impact, that would have affected my decision to recommend such a project. You know, spending $5 million on 2,000 acres versus 20,000 acres is not inconsequential. And I guess the question is sort of for me and for the rest of the council, what do we do about that?
That's a good question. You know, these aquatic projects, it's not about acreage to me as much as it is populations of native species. So it's almost like I'd rather hear about, you know, the size of the fishery that it affects because it isn't like a land project. But so that's one thought that I have, just kind of off the. But what happened to the first project? Why did it become not feasible specifically?
That's an excellent question. I can give you the answer to it. I don't have it to talk with. Mr. Irvin is able to join us here before the meeting ends.
I think that's actually in this stuff, which is the city of Big Stone did a diversion that made the project impossible.
Okay. I guess I'd rather hear about, you know, the stock that's there and, you know, the status of that those populations, you know, the variety of species and what difference you expect to see out of it. Like, are you looking for a 15% bump up or a 50 or 300 type? To me, it's more like, you know, what is it going to do to the native species there, their habitat?
Mr. Chair?
Mm-hmm.
So I think Ms. Hankson raised an excellent point, and that's something that we've talked about is, you know, we've been struggling, I know, as many others have, with trying to create quantifiable outcomes, not just outputs in terms of acres. Aquatic habitat, this project actually is a very good example, and other projects such as a dam removal to reconnect fish habitat, improve fish passage. Those are great examples of where an output acre per dollar is not a very effective measure, and it's not an apples to apples comparison between that project and a burning prairie, for instance. And so I think we're trying to wrestle with how to create better outcomes that better represent the impacts to fish habitats. And another good example on the wildlife side would be when a barrier is put up that allows us to do water control structures, or water control structures put in to allow us to raise and lower wetlands. The impact, population impact, is much larger than that immediate acreage, and it would be nice if we could find a standard way to be able to report that. So we're certainly interested in working towards that.
And really, that's not all that different from land either. I mean, you can talk about acres fully blue in the face, but it really has to do with the viability of native species and the health of that, you know, the health of the overall ecosystem, how you measure that.
Mr. Chair. And let me just one more response to your initial question. The actual impact to the populations is probably not going to be substantially different. There's about 75 miles, we figure, of channel that is going to be probably used. So 75 miles of channel that contain fish that will be using this habitat. And as you know, fish travel substantial distances, and from here down around 75 miles is what we figure is a good estimate of the populations and the populations using that habitat.
And what are the major species that we're talking about?
It's pretty much every major population. It's the Minnesota River, so it's walleye. It's a variety of lesser known native species. It's northern pike. It's bass.
Yeah. Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
I do have a couple of questions when appropriate.
I think it's appropriate.
Mr. Grant, I got a question for you. You know, we're spending some time talking about the difference in the outcomes and this and that, and the chair indicated that the city of Big Stone had done some sort of a diversion, which made the project location upstream of Big Stone no longer viable. And my question to you is did the Big Stone project come up after you submitted this, get approved during that time, or is this something that anybody that was really sharp should have known was on the docket and could very well have negatively impacted your proposal from the get-go? To me, moving it from one to another, that's an issue. But was the original project, I mean, was it very suspect or subject to failure based on a long-term if this diversion is taking place, was it a brand new idea, or was that diversion being planned or in the process long before you submitted your original application?
And just for clarification, Scott, it's actually the city of Brownsville, not Big Stone, that put in the diversion. That was my error.
Mr. Chair, I believe it's the city of Browns Valley.
Was that project in play before this project was submitted?
So,
Mr. Chair, I'd like to welcome Mr. Herman.
Mr. Chair, members of the council, I apologize for not being here when you started. I was at another meeting and didn't realize you could get to this one quite so quickly. But I will do my best to answer the question at hand. I'm the project manager for the Aquatic Habitat program. It's funded by the Sart Sam. Currently managing these, and was the one who submitted the plan amendment. The planning, I believe, was underway for the diversion at the same time that we were looking at planning this project, but I think we were not aware of the two concurrently. When we became aware as that diversion was being constructed, we had already submitted our plan, or our proposal, I mean. And so I think that once we have become fully aware of the potential impacts of that diversion is going to have to the project, we realized that it had serious potential to undermine benefits that project might have. We've seen other instances where these diversion channels have been cut where, because the floodwaters are carried away from the original channel, the stream no longer has the same amount of energy to be able to move sediment. And so what can happen is that that channel then fills in with sand and other fines. It isn't a very good substrate for spawning fish. And so once we became aware of that full potential for that to happen with the project, we thought it best to look for other sites to use the money.
Mr. Chair?
Yep.
The question I have is this. If this change of project location or this accomplishment plan is not approved, would those funds then flow back to the outdoor heritage, or would the DNR Aquatics Department get another opportunity to submit yet another project?
The DNR would have the opportunity until the money is unavailable by statute to submit alternative projects.
Mr. Chair, they have a list as well at the back of their accomplishment plan that they could apply the funds to. I believe it's in excess of the amount appropriate.
Mr. Chair?
Yep.
Did I hear you accurately that the new proposed project site is 75 miles south of the dam structure on Big Stone?
No, I think what was said was that the effect could be on fish that range as far as 75 miles that would be able to use the improved habitat. Is that correct?
And how many miles of upstream habitat from this project to the dam is there?
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, Commissioner, the distance is approximately 15 to 20 miles downstream from the outlet of Big Stone Lake. But there's downstream of the project probably in the neighborhood of 250 miles of Minnesota River Channel downstream as well.
But I think his question is from the new project site to the Granite Falls Dam, which is, I assume, something that keeps you the fish from going upstream. How far is that?
Yeah. Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now I understand the question better. It's a pretty short distance from the current site upstream to the Granite Falls Dam. It's probably in the neighborhood of a mile to 2 miles.
Does that answer your question, Scott?
So the fish currently can get to this site, but we would be improving that, but they would not. There would be a very short distance of additional available improvement upstream of that. Is that accurate?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Commissioner, that's correct. The distance upstream from the site is relatively short. Typically, the behavior of most fishes when they want to spawn is to swim upstream. Typically, the higher gradient regions that fishes seek out for spawning habitat tend to be upstream. And so most of the fishes that would be utilizing the structure would be coming from below.
So can you tell us what the cost of the particular improvements that were proposed and you're asking for a replacement would be?
Mr. Chair, Commissioners, the two projects are actually quite similar. The plan was to have on the Little Minnesota River bringing in some rock substrates to enhance the bottom cover type so that it would be of the more suitable type that fishes use for spawning. And also some shaping of that rock so that it would maintain a little bit higher velocity to keep those rocks and gravels clean of finer materials. The idea is the same at this new site we're going to work on, although the one difference is the site that we're going to work on potentially in Granite Falls, there is actually a site historically before that. There was a dam that was removed downstream of the site that we're at right now. It's not the Granite Falls Dam, but it's a different dam that was removed within the last 2 years. You may have heard about that in the news. There was some news coverage about it. So that's opened up that access from below. But when that dam was removed, it also lowered the water level where this current project's proposed. And uncovered when that happened was an old cart path that had probably been installed, 100 years ago or so, where they actually piled a bunch of rocks and things in there to be able to ford across the river. Well, once we dropped the water level down, you could see that again. It's got a couple cuts where the river flows through it. But currently, it's altering the flow patterns quite a bit of the river, and it's actually kind of a navigation hazard in some ways, too. The idea is to use some of that material that's already there, reshape it into that shape that I was saying we would do on that other site to channel the flow to a certain path so that it would maintain some cleaner substrates. We'll probably bring in some larger rock to enhance that a little bit to make sure it's going to be stable and stay in place. So we're trying to accomplish more or less the same sorts of goals at each of the sites, and the costs are pretty equivalent.
And the costs are?
$40,000 for both projects.
So
either one.
So the real issue here is that we were told there would be 1 acre, and they're coming back with a change that is dramatically reducing the acreage effective. And it's about our perception of that, not about the money. I don't want to put words in anyone's mouth, but $40,000 one place or another of the 5.2 is not as much the issue of the fact that we went from 14,000 acres to 2,000.
Mr. Chair?
Denny's first.
I was just going to make a motion to approve it. I didn't realize it was 40 grand.
Okay.
I thought we were talking about millions.
So we have a motion on the table. Scott?
No problem. I don't need anything.
Okay. Jane?
One more quick question. Was the old dam right over here where it shows like a rapids or something?
Yes, Commissioner,
and
Chair,
the,
that is the old dam.
And the cart path is like the French drain that you were describing is up near the new site at the big corner there, that big dam?
Commissioner, Mr. Kingston, Mr. Chair, the cart path, although it's not visible in this picture, I think the picture was taken at a higher water level. It's right near that highway bridge that you can see that crosses the Minnesota River. It's about...
How big a drop in the elevation of the water?
Well, the Commissioner, Ms. Kingston, the drop in elevation of the water, the cart path sticks up during low water levels by a foot or two above the water on the sides. Like I said, there's some channels that have been eroded away through it so that it probably drops as somewhat of a rapids through there at the moment, a foot or two, I would say.
Okay. Any other comments? Sandy, call the roll, please.
Jane Kingston?
Yes.
Representative McNamara?
Yes.
Sue Olson?
Yes.
Scott Rall?
Yes.
Senator Saxon?
Yes.
Elizabeth Wilkins?
Yes.
Bob Anderson?
Yes.
Jim Cox?
Yes.
Chair Hartwell?
Yes, with a strong I don't want to see a project come through again that changes the acreage like this. You guys figure out how to tell the truth when you come to the first bus, because it changes dramatically the sense of what we're approving when we get it. I get that it's about populations, but you need to do a better job.
Senator Ingridson?
Yes. All right. It's approved. Someone else want to take me on this one?
Thank you, Chair.
I hope I spoke for all of us in that. Next is review and amend for public review the call for funding. And I'd just like to note, thanks to the staff for flagging this issue and bringing it to our attention. They could have approved this plan, and obviously the money wasn't really the issue, but it is about what we're told is going to happen and what's not, and I really appreciate the staff brought that issue to our attention.
Charlie, we ready?
Yep.
Okay. For the record, my name is Charlie Peterson, Management Analysis and Development at Minnesota Management and Budget. I've been working on the 25-year framework call for request, review, and update. With me is Maggie Edwards. She is going to operate the computer once we get into the call. If there's any changes to the document, we can do most of them live and be able to see them as they move forward. Clarify, align, and simplify. There were three words that I heard when I interviewed all of you in August and September, when we talked to conservation leaders in November. We heard the clarify and simplify piece of the call. Took that charge, created a small group made up of three members from the council here, Jane Kingston, Sue Olson, and Scott Rawl, along with Sarge Sams out there here, each council staff, and myself. We met twice, once in December, once in January. And before you is the product of that work with the rewrite of the call. In a nutshell, most of the changes in the call are edits. I went back to try and look at some of the language, and we pulled a lot of the language from the old call. We did more organizing and structuring around it, but I'd say probably 75% is almost direct from that piece. I'll go through a little bit more of what we looked at and some of the steps. I don't know whether Ms. Kingston, Ms. Olson, or Mr. Rawl have any just sort of overall comments before we get into it.
Yes, thanks. It looks quite a bit different than what we've done before, but it really isn't. As we picked through literally word by word and line by line, we realized that there was duplications and triplications of many of the sections. There used to be two lists. We kind of merged them together into one because there was duplication. To the extent that some of the requirements that were listed for proposals were specifically called out in the statutory requirements for proposals, we elected to pull those out and make reference to the statutory sections instead. So it really isn't that different. It's just taking out the duplications and putting things in an order that seemed to make more sense.
Any other additional comments? Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
I concur with Sue on the changes that were made to the language the changes that were made to sentences, this and that. I think there was pretty unanimous consent amongst the working group on those specific changes. It was designed to make it not as many pages as War and Peace, and I think we were successful in making that those forms, making the call a little bit less cumbersome, easier to understand with less duplication. So the product that is before you certainly has my support on the actual language of the call that we're talking about. We have a couple of other things to talk about that we don't have unanimous consent on, but the specific language that you see, I think the group was very unanimous on.
Okay, with that, go ahead.
I'll proceed. You have a packet of information on this in front of you. There's several items in there. The first item is sort of a cover memo and an outline in general of what we did. I'll sort of use that as an agenda for this process. Second item is the revised final draft call as it is at the moment. underneath that is the tan-colored sheet. I sent out a draft of this language early this week on Monday. Since that time, we've been looking at some dates, had those clarified. Those changes have been made. We've also gotten the information back from ranking of the priority actions, and that information has been put in. What that TAN document does is show you the difference between the version you got on Monday and what the final draft version is today. And then the last document is the tally sheet or score sheet on that survey poll on the priority actions. And we'll get to that in a moment. Moving back to the memo, I'd sort of like to walk through the pieces there, more just seeing if there's any comments or questions on them. The first piece is just simply to add the constitutional language that was adopted in 2008 to the call for request. That is attached with specific areas emphasized on the back of page 2. Does anybody have any problem with that? Let me run that. Okay. The next piece is to look at, primarily it's pages 1 through 4. This is where most of the edits and changes occurred. At this point in time, I'm going to sort of just look at them by pages and see if anybody has any issue or if anybody has any questions in general. Page 1 just provides an opening statement and what defines a successful applicant. Most of that is taken from the 2015 policies and edits. Any comments on that? Changes? Page 2, again, is that constitutional amendment language. Page 3, at section 1, where it talks of proposals must, that comes primarily from the guiding principles of the old document. Any questions on that? Yes.
Number 6, it says must be a primary benefit to fish, game, wildlife, and what?
And 7.
And 7.
Right, and 7.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7.
But I think your point is well taken. The and is confusing. It has to be there. You can't just have a list without an and.
Well, it makes it inclusive. It makes it total.
Okay.
It must meet all 7 of those bullet items.
So I'm hearing you move on? Okay, thank you. Section 2.
Excuse me, may I interrupt?
You bet. Sure.
Okay, I'm sorry. I was a couple pages behind. That's not unusual for me in the morning, particularly. The There is a question I have at the bottom of page one, and that refers to the funding request and the constitutional language and all. And that first bulleted item consisted with the Minnesota Constitution statute and state law and laws on tribal self-governing harvest regulation. I'm wondering, you know, we had this opportunity to work with the tribe their proposal this year, and we had some questions involving the differences between the hunting regulations on wolves. So I'm wondering, when we say and on all of these, Minnesota Constitution statute and state law and laws on tribal self-governing harvest regulations, are we getting into a problem here where we have two conflicting statements when the state law differs from the tribal harvest regulations?
Greg, can you help us with what the and means?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure that that's a problem. You know, it's kind of wherever these things are appropriate. And I don't think that you could try to put it in an or there, but where there's a difference between state law and laws on tribal self-government, but you know, they're not necessarily. There's a conflict sometimes between what state law is and what the laws on tribal self-governing harvest regulations are. But I'm just not sure that having an and there really causes a problem. I think it's really where appropriate. So you're just kind of supposed to fit into all of those things.
Sue?
I agree with Greg. Because the sentence starts out with that it needs to be consistent with the various kinds of laws, there are already structures set up in the laws for which laws take precedent over another when there's a conflict, and then you just simply would be consistent with that. It's not saying everything is applying. It's just saying your proposal needs to be consistent.
Does that answer your question, Elizabeth?
Yes, it does. I was wondering about the and or the or between the state law and the tribal self-governing harvest regulation. I didn't know if or was more appropriate, but I see where you're coming from, and I defer to the attorneys there. So thank you.
All right. Continue.
Go back to page 3. And we talked of the proposals must in section 1. Section 2, the minimum screen qualifications. Actually, sections 2 and 3 came from the criteria and requirements. We sort of massage those together and pull them apart. Minimum screening qualifications are those 1 through 5. These are the things that an application has to have. And if any comments or questions on those?
Okay.
Number 1, I just want to make sure that we have it written such that it doesn't preclude first-time applicants that could still meet every other criteria, every other requirement. I mean, I can't come up with an example, but I don't want to exclude anyone on that basis. It depends on the project. It depends on the project. And the applicant.
If you remove the word similar and just said have a record of successful management and implementation of project programs being requested, so you didn't get into the scale. I think you're asking the scale question. What if someone's only done 100 acre restoration and wants to do a 200 acre restoration?
Yeah, it seems to limit who can qualify to me. Based on scale.
Other thoughts on that? You want to propose something?
Could you change this to have the capability of successful management and implementation, something like that, so you could encourage folks that can show you that they have that capability, but don't have a record of it?
Dane's nodding. Sue's nodding.
Chair?
Yep.
If you took out the word scale, that would solve that problem, would it not? Just remove the word, leave everything the same, remove the word scale. And that would allow somebody who's done projects smaller to do projects bigger.
Seeing some nods.
I think the capability of the either better.
And some from.
I didn't hear the last comment, Mr. Chair.
The comment was that capability was perhaps a better thing to put in than to remove scale.
Have a record of successful management and implementation of the project. Or capability.
Demonstrated capability.
Read the sentence off with demonstrated capability of successful management.
I think that's better.
So would it be okay to change this to demonstrate a capability of successful management and implementation of project programs similar in scale, scope, and complexity to the project being requested? I think we're almost setting up a demonstrate the capability to do this similar in scale, scope doesn't make sense to me. One you either demonstrate and the other you've done.
We're trying to get it up on the language up. It's demonstrate a capability of successful management and implementation, and the rest carries on.
And I'm saying I think that's a little bit problematic, because programs similar in scale scope, if you're demonstrating your capability and then you're going to similar, you set up a conflict in your sentence. But have a capability of management and implementation project programs. It's the scale, scope, and complexity that we're getting hung up in here. Similar project programs. So if we took out, have a record of successful management and implementation of project programs similar to the project programs being requested, that's what you're suggesting, Bill, and take out scale, scope, and complexity?
I think that's better.
Let's go. If we may, I want to try and pull it up. Take out what you did. Let's have a record of successful management and implementation of project and programs to the project programs being requested.
Similar to.
Thank you. Yes.
Now, but does that is similar to limited?
Not as much as it did before.
Well, but let's go back to the chair's point of 100 acres versus 200 acres. Excuse me.
How about just demonstrating the capability to successfully manage and implement the project programs?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, if someone comes in and wants to do 200 acres and they've only done 2 acres and they have a part-time staff and they don't have a plan, they can't demonstrate it to us.
So we're back to demonstrate a capability to successfully manage and implement
the project programs being requested.
Successfully implement the the projects and programs being requested. Mm-hmm. You want to leave management in there.
Yeah.
So demonstrated capability to successfully manage and implement.
Yep.
The projects and programs being requested. Implement projects and programs. Take it out through the S.
So while that's getting pulled together, are there other issues in this section?
Yes.
Jim?
At the bottom of page 2, the applicants are strongly discouraged from submitting more than one request covering the same work. And I think we should prohibit that. If we leave it in and people do that, it skews our process when we start to allocate money. Because we can, same project, the same work can be allocated money twice. I don't see why there's any reason why somebody would submit the same work in more than one project.
Charlie, you have...
Yeah, all I want to do is confirm the change that we made, and then we can go on to this. Demonstrate a capability to successfully manage and implement the project and programs being requested.
Yep.
Take out the and.
Take out the and. Everyone okay with that?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thanks. Sue, you have a response to that.
Yeah, actually the committee went back and forth many, many, many times on whether to strongly discourage them or flat out prohibit. The problem had come up that there were examples, none of which I can remember now, but there were examples of times when they needed to have something in two different places. But by adding the second sentence that if it is in more than one place, you have to clearly show that it is, so that it's not just getting backdoored somewhere. So,
Mr. Chair, a specific example is the Nature Conservancy and the Tall Grass Prairie and the Prairie Plant. And they are doing the same thing, going after the same properties. So do we use this... Are we required as a result of this to disregard it?
Jim?
I don't understand your point there. You mean that like three different groups are all doing the same work? Or both?
Same group, same stuff. Two different people.
Chair?
Scott?
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, just a second. Jim, you want to follow up on
that? I still don't understand your point there, Bill.
It's the same request, requesting entity. They are listing the same properties in two different requests. The Tallgrass Prairie request and the Prairie Partnership request.
Okay.
And so this would cause us to ask them to withdraw.
And I think they'd have to withdraw both if we had the prohibition in there, not just withdraw one.
Yeah, I think if I understand, I'm going to disagree with that. You mean if the Nature Conservancy, through their proposal, and because the Nature Conservancy is affiliated with the Northern Tallgrass Prairie, that you're considering that the same?
They are proposers of both. They are the project manager of both. They are in charge of both. There are no two ways about it.
Makes me very uncomfortable. I think you choose one. My own opinion is you choose one or the other, but you can't come in twice and on the same program. I think there is potentially, you know, what do you do when there is an overlap in Pheasant Forever and Ducks Unlimited and Nature Conservancy on one edition to a WMA somewhere that they didn't know each other were putting in. But I think when the same group starts proposing to do the same work on the same property, that's problematic. and that they ought to choose. And I prohibit it myself.
Eric?
Yeah, Scott?
I strongly agree that the word prohibited should be there. We had that came up in our conversation. But what brought me to some kind of compromise on that was told me that when Veterans Forever puts forth a project of their proposal, which has a list of sites on it, that another group couldn't bring forth a proposal that would share even one common project on a different list. If we said prohibit, then any time there was even one site overlap, that would cause problems. I don't necessarily agree that that's the case. The only reason that I would use discourage instead of prohibit would be if two separate entities under two separate proposals couldn't each list the same project. Now, they try not to do that, but if there happened to be one overlap where PF and the DNR had one high-priority site listed in both proposals, that would somehow eliminate one proposal. If that is not the case, then I think we should say prohibited.
What about duplicate requests from the same applicant will result in an automatic rejection of both proposals? Because that gets around one group not knowing what the other is doing, but trying to protect the same property. And that's going to happen. But TNC applying twice for the same thing, they know they're doing that.
One of the concerns from the working group was also that if one applicant is just this small group and the other applicant is seven people together that merge their projects, which just happened last year,
yeah,
then that rule's not going to do anything with it. If you at least get, you know, the second language saying you have to declare it so it's obvious to everybody that same project is included in two different applicant groups' proposals. But, yeah, we talked about this a lot.
So in implementing this policy, you have the Met Council making one application, Dakota County making another application. Same project?
Yes.
But they're two different applicants.
Well, Mr. Chair?
Yeah?
What would happen if we added to the very end of that, if an individual project is contained in another proposal, it must be clearly declared, and only one proposal can be funded. Would that solve our issue?
Jim?
No, I don't think it will, Scott. I think the issue is it's the same proposer proposing the same project twice. It's not if different proposers happen to propose the same, doing work on the same project. That's a different issue. I don't think we're worried about that. We're worried about the same proposer bringing forth the exact same work more than one time.
If we put down individual applicants are prohibited, that would fix that. Individual applicants are prohibited from submitting more than one request covering the same work.
I think what Bill is, we all know what the intent is here. We're struggling with the words. The intent is we don't want one group coming in twice for the same project, or essentially the same project. And maybe we need to just put it in that kind of language, where instead of, we could say something to the effect of individual applicants cannot come in for funding for the same project, or the council reserves the right to reject both applications. and not get so specific that we create the problems. And when there is a little bit of fluff somewhere because of something, we can still deal with it.
Yeah, parcel lists aren't the same as projects.
Sue, you had...
Yeah, one of the things that we've looked at when we were trying to figure out the language was switching around the subject of the sentence. So instead of being the applicant, it was the work, which wouldn't necessarily be the parcel list. It would be the work that they're doing on that project, that the work can't show up in more than one application. And I'm not sure that, as I recall, that that was going to necessarily work either, because they may not realize that a different applicant had it also, that maybe two different groups are working on the same project and they just happened to go over, and then are you penalizing them by automatically kicking them out? But we really struggled, and this is in response to the Met Council putting in a project and then having Dakota County and some of the others put in the exact same thing separately, because then we had them twice, but with different applicants.
Any other thoughts on what to do here? I mean, we have to do something. Everybody's saying we ought to do something. The committee or the task force tried to come up with something. I think we're saying a little stronger than that, but not limiting and creating problems. Got it?
Would this preclude then two appropriations bundling funds in order to say, a very large acquisition?
I don't think
because
so.
Because the parcel for the program or project would show up then on two budgets.
Well, if you say reserves the right, then we can look at what we have and make a decision appropriately when you have the facts.
Mr. Chair, I think that's an important point. If the council itself wants to implement this regulation, this desire, we can do it as a council. I think where we get into trouble is telling staff to go stop it.
Right.
Because I don't want to be in a situation where we're accused of being arbitrary. And we've got one situation that people think we ought to tell them to go away. And we've got another one where the same rules apply to a dispassionate outside observer.
Jim?
Bill, I mean, if we put it in our call, then that we're going to stop that process, stop you from having to do that.
No.
Why is that?
Because it's not clear.
Well, if we make it clear.
It is not a clear process. The world of conservation is not discrete.
I think it...
It just isn't clear, Jim.
David, could you repeat your original motion or suggestion?
There were several of them. I'm assuming it is the last one. Individual applicant cannot come in for funding for the same project, and the council reserves the right to reject that proposal. There's some editing that needs to happen, and that we can get to that. But that's the concept.
And I would say both.
Yes.
No, not just one or pick one or two, which is what we did the last time.
Yeah.
At risk to ourselves, if we just say, look, if the intent here is to get around our process, we're just going to say no. If there's a reasonable reason for doing something, we can talk about it. Work. Conceptually, can everyone live with that? If we let them wordsmith? Anyone not able to live with that? All right. Other things with Section 2? I had a question for the task force. You know, we had a discussion about the $400,000. And we clearly you're trying to say this is, you can't come in for $200,000. Staff felt they didn't have the authority to do anything about a proposal that came in for $200,000. It still had to be submitted to us. Is this language strong enough in 5?
which would be requests must. Yeah.
There's a must at the header because everything comes down from applicant and applicants must. So the must is already there at the beginning of the list of 1 through 5.
So does staff feel comfortable saying the proposal for $200,000 you kick back and don't put it in the process?
Mr. Chair, there's no interpretation about the size of the request.
Thank
it's
you.
Clear.
All right. Just thought I'd ask.
The only issue I have with that is that it might encourage some to beef up arbitrarily their application quantity.
And then we'll cut it down.
And we'll have to cut it down.
We can't prohibit people from exaggeration.
Correct.
But we can treat the exaggeration with due respect.
Totally. Many times.
Anything else on Section 2? Section 3.
And if I may, most of Section 3, we reordered what we sent out in on Monday, which starts with first the staff reviewing and whether or not they meet those three criteria. Then the second B is scoring item for staff, and then C are the council's scoring criteria, the eight items there. The concept, and this is the alignment piece, the concept is those eight items will become the scoring items that the application score sheet is built from.
So explain to me the staff reviews proposals. What do they do with their review in this? What's the process?
I'll take that one. If you look at the old call, you'll see this language was already in there as things that either the proposal had to do or the council needed to do. What we did when we were looking at it on a line-by-line basis was look at the things that were clearly objective, that had yes, no answers, that didn't necessarily need to have the council, the full council, make the determination, because it would just be a, is it here, yes or no, and then move on. So somebody else would take that piece away from the council. The council would be left with the stuff that everybody argues about. So it was some reordering of things and taking the objective criteria and moving over.
So does the staff recommend, provide the council with its interpretation of whether it's yes or no in these cases?
Correct.
Because that's a significant change. I just want to be very clear.
Any?
Sure. The question I have, I guess, in looking at the information that comes to us, will we still have sustainability and maintenance? Will we still have government approval? Will all those items still be a part of the information that we receive?
The applications themselves aren't changing. The information that we get in our packets is the same. It's just that the three or four objective criteria that can be done by basically anybody with the yes-no answers would be done by the staff before we're getting the applications. So you still get the full application just like you got before, but we score on less criteria.
So, in essence, the staff gives you a pass-fail.
Yes.
How does that pass-fail then figure into our scoring? If there's a fail on the staff side, and we're still scoring on all this criteria, how does the fail get taken into consideration on the scoring criteria that we do?
It wouldn't kick it out, just like anything else wouldn't kick it out. If we think an application in last year's process completely missed the boat on one of the criteria, we didn't just not look at the rest of the application. We just get that as information when we're looking at the applications.
Okay, but we're going to then score it. So you've got project that you happen to like a lot, but the staff says it doesn't meet this criteria. There's no way for you to score the lack of that criteria of the stuff that it was supposed to contain when you do your review and score it and share those scores with everybody else, if I guess what I'm asking. And so if we do our numerical, you know, everything above this or whatever else, there's no consideration of the fact that it's missing some other stuff that staff identified.
That's still there. That information is still there. It's just not the council member's individual score piece. So you're still seeing that, and that information comes along with the council member's scoring information that goes out to the public. Or we could flip those four things back to us, and then we've got 12. Either way. It just seems that if it's objective, and the staff can look at some of those things because they're better able to say, does it meet everything in the statute, versus us making a statutory determination, would it make sense to have the staff say it does or it doesn't?
I guess all I'm asking is, if it doesn't, do we want some ability when we score it to take that into consideration?
Oh.
And it doesn't.
Chair?
Yes, Scott.
My question is this. If the staff scored on those three criteria, wouldn't we have those outcomes before we then scored the proposal? I mean, they come in, they're put together, and they're all put in order and all of that, put in that binder. Wouldn't staff's interpretation of those three items already be completed by the time it got to us, which would then very much affect our scoring of that project as that process went forward? For them to do this and not have it to us prior to our scoring efforts makes this immaterial. I mean, the only way this works is if they do that in the process of receiving applications, make the determination to us prior to our scoring of the project.
The intent was we would have it when we receive the application.
If we had it, Scott, and let's go to clearly describe the proposed leverage effort and other non-state funds to supplement the requested amount. So the answer is, yeah, they leverage it, or no, they don't leverage it. How does that affect our scoring? I mean, it's a big deal to me whether or not someone wants to match dollar for dollar or has no leverage at all. And if staff has scored it and said, here's what it is, and we're not taking it into consideration when we're providing a ranking of the proposals.
Oh,
somehow.
I see what your question is. No, the staff's scoring would be included with the rankings. So if that leverage item happened to score a 5 on a scale of 7, that 5 is included with all of the other components that we're doing when the ranking is made.
Okay. That's a different story.
It took me till then to understand what you're asking.
Jane?
No, you know, we had 2 meetings on this, and we've been talking about criteria and scoring for a long time. And none of this is nailed down in my mind. In fact, B, leverage, I think maybe is more properly the council piece. And 6 under C, fully describing how the request funding supplements versus substitutes, maybe that's more properly staffed. I guess, you know, if there's any question, I think it should be in front of the council to flesh out all the detail that we need to flesh out. I'm not married to any of the numbers in terms of how many criteria there are. I'm more concerned about getting all of the questions answered in a structure that everybody recognizes. So, you know, this is very fungible in my head still.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair,
mm-hmm.
I just want to remind members that staff has no appointment papers or anybody put us on this council to make these decisions. And I was reminded very early in this process that this is about the council. And the council. It's not about staff. So be very careful in integrating staff into these decisions.
You know, and if we have a scale to answer all these questions, and we come up with one of the criteria that are objective, that is either yes or no, and it's either 1 or 9, or 1 or 7. And if it's gray, it's 5. I mean, whatever. You can figure it out.
Tom, do you
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Elizabeth.
I'm still a little confused about I think that staff, having a staff review, particularly some of these criteria is very important, but I'm confused as into what manner, what form that would be presented to us as we're looking over the proposals and we take into consideration their comments. Is it going to be in comments that they're going to submit this on the proposals in a separate sheet, or how will this be presented to us as we review our proposals?
Bill?
Mr. Chair, we will try to do yes-no responses.
And I think that's possible in the A group. I don't think it's possible in the B.
I agree.
Well, the B group was one that went back and forth a couple of times. Like, as Jane said, we're not married to this.
Oh, come on. I know you are.
No, not really.
Not really.
Oh, Mr. Chair?
Yeah?
If we just moved the B group down and made that one a C, left the A group 1, 2, and 3, and moved the B group, make it a 1 and move everything else down, would that solve our dilemma?
It would certainly make it easier for me to understand.
What do we need to put that in a motion, or do I just need to make a recommendation to do that, or what?
I'm looking around the table to see nods. What you're really doing is killing B as a standalone paragraph and moving the bullet point underneath it into C.
Correct. And I recommend we do that.
What do people think about that? I'm seeing nods.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for the suggestion, Scott.
With that, just the edit piece would include, as a phrase, the board does the proposal clearly describe whether the proposal leverages effort, et cetera, et cetera. That would match the language that's in C.
Yes.
Which
is now B.
We'll let you edit okay. The language.
Which is now B.
Which is now B. Yeah, C is now B, so. And I'm just going to throw this out. I wanted to do this when we do the scoring. There is something about some proposals that grab your attention and just make you feel good or not good. I call it the bang for the buck. You know, where is someone doing something that really makes a difference that's not necessarily one of these individual things, but is a huge deal or the potential, at least in the reviewers. And I'd love to have a category that's simply bang for the buck.
Basically, you're thinking like the intangible score of, you know, on an overall sense, I really, really, really like this, or I really, really don't care.
Yeah.
I'd be all right with that.
Not real objective. Well, a lot of it isn't.
It's not real objective, but it does. I mean, if there's a project that pushes the envelope a little bit and you really want to give it a boost, or it's just, you know, most of them I think are going to come in and the way I'd score a 5 kind of on that, and some are going to be this is dumb, and the others are going to be this is really stunning, and it lets me share with everybody else that how do I feel about this overall versus specific criteria that's not about, you know, your gut intuition. Jane, you looked very unhappy with that
process. Can't come to a decision, and I think that's a lot of has a lot of subtext to it. It's not easy.
It's not easy.
And I'm also thinking patient, you know, the council should do all of this. As I said, we have 2 meetings.
You're nodding. Yep.
Oh, I'm agreeing.
That we ought to do all of it? And that my suggestion is too difficult?
Well, I don't know.
It seems subjective.
It's very, very, I mean, it's just.
I'm not stuck on it. I just.
I know exactly what you mean. And it seems to me that all your scores together should come up with that gut feeling. I mean, I agree with the concept, but I just don't know how you make it anywhere near being scientific or traceable or quantifiable or measurable.
That's fine. Just thought I'd bring it up. So we do have a suggestion from Jane, a member of the task force, to take A and really, or take C, no, take A out of here and put all of this back onto the council instead of asking staff to do part of it. Do you want to talk about why you are suggesting that?
Well, it has to do with drawing a line between who's responsible for what. And we're responsible for scoring projects. We're responsible for standing behind why we score them the way we do. That's what we're here to do. I don't want to foist off or advocate my responsibility to staff. I think we should be working with staff to come up with, if you have a blurry area, call them up, you know. And it's based on what you were saying as far as statutory, whose job is it. I don't want to duck out from what we're here to do.
Other thoughts?
I want to hear what Heather has to say. She worked with us on all this, too.
I have
you know, that was your idea in the beginning.
What?
It's a working piece. Work in progress.
What other
things? Mr. Chair?
Yes, Scott.
You know, Jane's recommendation to move A, B, and C, A and B, and put them all under C, I think is, and I wasn't at the first meeting where this was somewhat involved, but if we move A and B and put them all under C, that would then eliminate anybody saying, well, you know, we did really good, but the staff didn't like us, or, you know, there was some conflict or confusion between staff and the council. If we put all of A and B under C, then there is only one entity that can be questioned or, you know, and I agree with Jane. I think if we move A and B and put them all under C, that gives us the most clear and concise who did what, who scored what, who was involved in the decision as to whether a project ultimately got money or not. Would leave that all squarely on the shoulders of council members where I think it belongs. So I'll follow with Jane and make a recommendation that all of A and B be moved under C.
Anybody object to that?
The clarification?
Yeah.
C says the staff will review proposals. A says the council will review.
No, you got that backwards. C is that the staff will recommend, A is that the staff will review, and C is that the council will review.
Okay, my copy says differently. Well,
I don't know where your copy came from, but you can trust me that C is the council's responsibility.
Okay, I may well be under, I'm under section 2, so am I in the wrong spot?
Yes. You should be under section 3 on page 4.
Ah, section 2.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
She may have an old version, the one that was sent out Monday.
Yeah.
And between Monday and today, we reordered those sections.
So, Elizabeth,
she is correct, but we've changed it.
We've changed it. Okay. Trust us.
Okay. I'm going to duck you guys. I'm sure it has been changed, but yes, that's the one I pulled down. So that's why my question.
Thank you for your question. Other parts in Section 3?
We are, just, again, point of clarification, we are moving the three bullets that are under A now, putting those under C, correct?
And killing A altogether.
Yep. Okay, and I don't see any word changes. Excuse me.
I would just delete all the strong headings and say LaSard sounds like a council members. Scratch on staff, delete on staff, review the written proposals to determine the extent to which the proposals have met these criteria, and then bullet items.
Okay. Want to keep going?
Yeah. If I may, those were the major substantial changes that the small group had agreement on. There was another issue that was raised that gets into the ecological sections, and that was the aspect of placing some level of rank or priority on the priority actions. Those were the pieces, the Survey Monkey survey that was sent out to you to score back. Someone from that small group wants to go into the rationale for ranking those. We can take a look at that. If the council decides to rank them, then we can go into the aspect of looking at what we got back from Survey Monkey and look at the specific order that we want to put them in.
Mr. Chair, this was Mr. Rawls' baby, so.
It certainly was. My rationale behind that, members, was if we ranked the priorities inside each of the ecoregions, and we asked the applicant to identify the top two priorities that their project addressed, and if we had a project that addressed our number one priority, and then that's our number five priority, that members might then say, this is the most important thing going on in the prairie zone, okay? Project addresses the most important, the most critical need. This project addresses a need but not as high a priority a need. Members might allocate their available dollars to the most pressing need in each ecoregion. And I'm not asking for those to have a weighted score or a weighted average or anything like that, just to identify what are our number one priorities in each, you know, region, and does the project address our highest priority? Now, that doesn't mean that a project that addresses the number five priority won't get money. It's just one more way for members, when they're trying to make a determination as to where they want to make an appropriation, is where in the list of our priorities does this project fall? And that's why I thought addressing or prioritizing the goals in each ecoregion would have value. Now, whether people agree or don't agree, you know, I can't imagine why we wouldn't want to fund our highest priority in each ecoregion, but we cannot do that today because we have not identified what is our number one priority in each ecoregion. So that was my thought process behind that.
So what do people think about that? I will say I struggled a little bit with the ranking, mostly when I came to the protect, enhance, or restore existing wetland and upland complexes, or convert agricultural lands to new wetland habitat complexes, because those are two separate things. Which one was I choosing? And so I felt very uncomfortable making that choice, because some of these are
have more than one thing in them, and so it felt very difficult for me to come up with a I'm really behind this or not, which was my, and what do you do when you've got something that covers two, a program that covers two of them, one's high and one's low, and but what part of the money would go to the high part versus the low part? It made me, and I understand the concept of it, Scott, but it made me uncomfortable because I think now you're going to have people saying, but you didn't fund your highest priority when you've got other things that are going to come into play in terms of just judgment. I think if we don't think it's a high priority, we ought to take it off our list. But that's just me.
Mr. Chair, I think it's worthwhile.
You make a very sound case.
Mr. Peterson could describe the advisor's discussion about this. Specifically, the position that when we talked to the people that we brought together, that the prioritization was part of the evaluation of the request.
Yep.
That you might have a something that addresses a something that would be comprehensively a priority three, but it does it in a fashion or a place that makes it an extremely important thing to do. And so they were saying use your review authority to set priorities and prioritize the programs that come before you.
And you can make those points on the record. You could do it in the score sheet, in the comments section, in your scoring. I mean, it's really implicit in all this whole activity.
Let me say another thing about this, just very briefly. The question of leadership comes up, and the question of whether or not the way these visions and priorities are laid out is the level of leadership the council wants to provide to applicants. And prioritizing is a little more leadership. Frequently another problem.
Sue?
When we talked about this, I wasn't a fan of prioritizing within each of the ecosystems because to me it was a lot like picking which one of your children you like best. I think they're all important. If they weren't important, they wouldn't have been on our list in the first place. I did love Scott's idea to make the applicant only pick the top two or three plans that they were addressing and not laundry list a check-off box of 20, because that isn't helpful and you end up not looking at any of it. So I there wasn't an option on the survey to say I don't want to do it, but I would have selected that option had it been there.
What about requiring the applicants to only select one or two priorities instead of doing a laundry list? Would that be helpful?
Yes. Top three.
I'm seeing nods on that. Anyone disagree with doing that?
Okay. Chair?
Yep, Elizabeth?
I do agree with, I would like to see the applicants choose the priorities of importance to them and make that a limited number. The one thing I did see about Scott's idea I thought valuable is that we can perhaps solicit more applications in areas that we think are higher priority to us at this point in time, because our scoring really is going to reflect those. When we end up scoring, the successful applicants are going to be the ones that are our highest priority. So if we can give them a little bit of an edge on saying, well, this is our thinking this year as to what we would like to concentrate on, I believe that might bring us more proposals in the areas that we want to focus on. That was my thought with the ranking of the actions under each of the eco regions.
Jane?
don't like that.
Can you explain why, perhaps? And use the mic so she can hear you, if you would.
Thank you. I think our priorities are laid out in each ECHO region, and I think that speaks for itself.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah?
When I brought up this conversation, I said early on, I said, I don't know whether prioritization in the ECHO region will ever be enacted or not. And I didn't have a high expectation that it would, but I wanted, and it doesn't appear that the group wants to do that, but I wanted to at least vet that idea and let the group decide whether or not they thought it had value. You know, I didn't do it with any jet engine lit under it that this was a super high priority for me and that I was going to campaign on its behalf till I ran out of breath. I am not that. I am glad that we've had the conversation. You know, it doesn't, I take your comments as to many of those priorities are more than one thing, and that in itself makes prioritization probably not possible or probable. And so I appreciate the council's discussion of this, but, I mean, as far as not ranking those criteria, I mean, I am convinced that we can move forward without that effort.
Would anyone strongly object if we didn't do anything with ranking the criteria?
I would not even mildly object.
Okay.
I would not object either. The only thing I would caution you on is that in reading, people always have a tendency to prioritize. When they come to the first item, they're going to consider that's your first priority because that was the first one you folks could decide on when you wrote the documents initially. So my suggestion would be that you may speak up a little bit. If you have priority actions, don't list the number one as number one every single year. They're going to list that.
That's a suggestion to applicants, not something relating to the call.
Yes. It could be relating to the call, too. If people new to this process and are looking through, they might see, well, that's their number one priority, even though it says they're not listed in order of preference or importance. That's just the way we read. That's a kind of a human nature thing, I believe.
Heather?
Mr. Chair, Member Wilkins, I just will point out that the existing call request does say priority actions are not in order of preference or importance.
And we'll remove the numbers and put in some symbol.
Do we want to limit the number of priorities that people list? I'm seeing a strong, you know, put your top two.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Correct.
Okay. Charlie, do you have a question? You look like you have a question.
You just answered both of them.
Sandy?
Okay, so top two per ECHO region?
Top two per your request.
For the proposal.
Okay.
It's an imperfect science.
The way we were looking at it when we were discussing it at the meeting Scott was at last week was it's like the multiple choice questions at college where you have all the answers are right, but pick your best two. And that's what we want the applicants to do is the two things that this thing really does, not everything it might possibly touch.
I'm sorry, I have a point of clarification.
So if a project or a program comes before us, which they often do, and they're spanning multiple ecological regions, you still want them only to pick two outcomes or two priorities, regardless of the number of ecological regions they cover?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I think if you don't do that, you incent people to go to more regions.
I think we're asking for the top two. We're not asking anybody to say they don't do something else. What's the biggest bang for the buck that they're
proposal would give. I'm going to get that in there somewhere.
Okay. And their narrative, you know, you could even add an extra narrative section, you know, if you want to discuss impact that you would have in other ecoregions, do so here, but then we don't have that laundry list of meaninglessness.
And as long as the narrative is succinct.
Or we won't read it.
Yep.
And I, just a point of clarification, we're only asking for the top two out of all of the ecoregions.
Yes.
Okay. I'll work.
Sandy, you.
Just a point of clarification from what Sue brought up. Did you also want to get for the plans then? The top two plans?
Yes. Yes.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Scott.
Sandy else, was she asking about the conservation plan?
Yes.
Yes.
And when we talked in our working group, I thought it was equally, if not more important, that each applicant only pick the top two conservation plans that their project lists. I would strongly encourage that we limit that only to two conservation plans per applicant.
Technically, I think it's conservation plan objectives, but...
And a clarification for Charlie, these are changes to the application, not to this thing that we've got on screen.
Thank you. Then let me step back. This conversation, the last, say, 10 minutes, we revert back to the call, to the language in the eco sections that is in the 2015 call.
Yes.
And leave it at that, with the caveat that the numbers are taken out and symbols are put in for the priority actions in each of the ecoregions. Okay, beautiful.
So, anything else with the call?
Mr. Chair, just wanted to ask the members that were in the small group whether we've handled invasive species the way we intended to handle them.
There was discussion in the second day of the small group meeting of making a reference to somehow dealing with invasive species in each of the ecoregions, because there aren't just aquatic invasive species. There are also other kinds of invasive species that would impact each of the ecoregions. And we had talked about possibly adding another bullet item beneath each one of those, something about some method of getting rid of them, dealing with them, making them stop. Everything from buckthorn to zebra mussels.
Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure the call reflects what the small group decided. And I think the answer is yes.
Yeah, we didn't. That's a whole other can of worms.
Yeah.
Not invasive groups, but native worms.
So, I think we're at a point where we'd like a motion to approve the call. I'd like the motion to include the ability for staff to make minor edits as they find language and those kinds of things as they go through this before they put it out for comment.
The approval is to make it public for comment.
It comes back with comments then for us to take final action.
Mr. Chair, does that include now the scoring in the application?
Yep.
We haven't talked about scoring.
I'm sorry.
Excuse me. I missed that conversation, and there was one other piece brought up. So there is also language on the last page that is the terms of funding, payment, and timing. So that is also part of that narrative. Those dates have been updated and checked under timing and schedule. The payment language, I was understanding that was also going to be changed in some way, shape, or form, or has been changed today. I don't know.
Mr. Chair, Charlie, while you were out of the room, a small work group of two is going to talk about payment language and support services.
But that won't be for public comment. That's just going to take place at the same time as.
Excuse me.
So scoring.
if I can go through the concepts that we had in the small group on scoring, looking at a two times of scoring. One is a pre-hearing, similar to what you do now, and then doing a post-hearing scoring. Post-hearing scoring that would happen, obviously, after the hearing. I think the time frame was to allow 7 days for that to happen. The conversation in the small group with the post-hearing scoring was a more detailed level of scoring. 7-point scale was suggested. For the pre-hearing, we had comments on both a shorter scale, a 3-point scale, or to stay with the larger scale and do it both pre and post.
So we had
some differing of opinions before and after.
1 to 10 or 1 to 3 is what you're talking about in terms of scale, right?
So, yeah, it would be whatever the other one.
So
with definitions.
Yeah. You have something to give us on
that. So in summary, the proposal that's being discussed on scoring is to do a pre-hearing score and a post-hearing score. The pre-hearing score is sort of a yes-no. It is to guide you in what you select to come in for hearing. The post-hearing score is on a 1-7, 1-something basis. And probably the same criteria, but more ability to react to it as a result of having heard the presentation.
Mr. Chair,
yep.
If I may, the red sheet that I handed out is just examples of a 3-point, a 5-point, and a 7-point scale.
So to work our way through this, we need to first decide whether or not we want a pre and a post. And then if we do...
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Scott.
This conversation that we're having that came out of the working group was one of those items that did not have universal agreement amongst the members of the working group. I can tell you that having been around for as long as the Outdoor Heritage Council has been around, I think that the protocols and the procedures that we have put in place, which have been tweaked over time, have served the council very, very well. Okay? We utilize those to determine who we're going to have a hearing from and who we're not. We're also, some of those protocols are in place in case we got 75 applications. You know, I can tell you that I believe that our current protocols of reading appropriate reading applications, giving them a score, then determining based on that detailed score, who gets a hearing and who doesn't, I think has served us well. I don't think we need a pre-score and a post-score. I've always said that once you score an application, you have a hearing, and then you make an appropriation, that your appropriation is your post-hearing score. Okay? We don't have, the staff has already indicated, that adding an extra week into the schedule for a post-hearing scoring activity, okay, is problematic. The schedule really doesn't allow very easily for that. So I'm gonna make as strong a case as I can that we preserve the process that we've used now for 5 rounds of funding, for which virtually our recommendations have been approved and put forth quite successfully. I would strongly encourage us not to make big changes in a program that has been proven to work and whose implementation would cause us scheduling problems. So I am very much in favor of using the process we currently have and not making any major changes to that. Now, the changes that we made in the criteria and whether we score 1 to 10 or 1 to 7, those are not big changes. But a yes, no, or a 1 to 3 pre-score and then a detailed post-score and the delays that would cause, those are big changes to our process. And as far as I'm concerned, our process is not broken. It does not need an overhaul. And I visited with some applicants over the last week and a half and said, you know, is it important to you to see whether your hearing improved your possibilities or deteriorated your possibilities? And that was not a high priority of applicants. I don't think that it's an overwhelmingly high priority of council members. I think we should preserve the process we have that has worked for 5 sets of recommendations and not make any major changes in the way that operates.
Okay. Sue?
Scott and I have polar opposites on this one, and he knows it, so that's why he started first. The reason I suggested the post-hearing score is because we go through all of this process to score things in great detail. The applicants get it, the public gets it, the other council members get it, everybody gets to see what you think. Then we have the hearings, and I found this was my first year going through the hearings that some of my scores changed drastically. Some of them went way up in certain categories because I was rescoring as I went, and some of them went way down as I was hearing the hearings. And my thought as a council person who's looking at what other council members think, just as the applicants and the public would, I wanted to know how much everybody else's scores changed, because relying on looking at somebody else's scores when they probably changed too, when we're looking at things like, gee, we've got an extra $1 million each to spend, how are we going to do it? The only transparency anybody has is the scoring that happened before the hearing. I think it's incredibly important for the public, the council members, and the applicants to know what the real score is after the hearing. I do not think that the allocation process is your score, because there's a lot of things that I would still score differently if I knew that the allocation was the only thing that ever counted. And I just get concerned of, if you don't want somebody to see what you rescore, why don't you want them to see it? Because I think it would be really, really useful for everybody.
Other thoughts? Jim?
Well, the only thing I'd say to that, Sue, is that, you know, I think at least most of the proposers, you know, during the conversation that we have when they're doing their proposal, get the understanding of what we had questions about or what we didn't like or where we thought they could do better. So I think they have an understanding of where we had issues. So I hate to put another step in the process simply because we always seem to be trying to squeeze things in time-wise. So I just don't see it as a necessary step myself.
Bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just thinking as I go along here, seeing a lot of the players at the roundtable and having a lot of discussion about the process over the last 5 years. In fact, that was our discussion as to how it has gone. I never once had anybody come up and say we should do this. There was anything wrong with the rating process. So I just don't know that there's anything broken that we need to change there. At least I'm not hearing that anyhow from those that come here every year.
Jane?
I'd just like to go on the record for saying I think Susan's instincts are right on and true. You know, having an open process and being accountable for what you do is critical to our job. But I really don't think there's that much value to look at what you scored once and then what you scored later, because it does come out in the appropriation that you recommend. It really does. And all the discussion you have between and throughout that whole point fleshes that out. There's no reason to think that it would be a better process, I don't think. I think that we're on the record with what we're recommending over and over again. But I think that Sue's instincts, and I have a problem with the scheduling and all that at this late date. It doesn't seem that late, but it really is when you get up against it and it's already been public noticed and everything. So I guess I'd have to stick with what we have, but you're going to have to be accountable. Everybody has to be, and it has to be open.
Other comments?
Mr. Chair?
Yeah?
As a new member, I was a little concerned that what we scored didn't seem to be taken into account when we looked at who was going to be invited, because we just simply invited everyone except for who we decided as a group we did not want to invite. And that will be very uncomfortable, because if we're using a numerical system, which I found was a bit cumbersome but okay to use, if we're using a numerical system, then we should stick with it and say, well, as a group, everyone under me, such and such a number just simply isn't invited. And that wasn't the case, and that's where, if we're going to do that in the future, then I'd just like to see a three-point scale. But if we want to really give feedback and then also utilize the numbers that we come up with as a group as a way to cut down the list of who's coming to a hearing, I would be very happy to continue with what we have. I just saw inconsistency between that very strong element of scoring and then just kind of casting that aside and saying, well, everyone can come except for who the group here says shouldn't come. So I think we need to stick with one or the other, but I don't know how to go about that. Those who have been on council longer should probably make that decision.
Mm-hmm. I had the same concerns, especially early on. At first, I wanted to hear everything. But as time goes on, I think you do gain an ability to sort out what isn't going to fly. And I think it does have to be accountable, but you can't do it prospectively, I don't think. Every year you get a different menu, you get a different mix, and you really can't make a final decision up front before you see what you've got as to what you're going to hear.
I also think there's the unknown.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think that this kind of comes down to is if the group would decide to make a change, they would have to be of the understanding that some part of our current process is broken, that it doesn't work, or that it's not getting us to an end result that we want. And yet I make the case that our current proposal is working. Our current procedures and policies work, and they have gotten us to great recommendations now for 5 years. I don't see any, you know, the old saying that if it isn't broke, don't fix it. And that's my mentality on this issue. This issue is not broken. Our procedures and policies have evolved over time, and they work great. So I'm going to strongly recommend that the group stay with the current plan that we have.
Okay. So I'm hearing not a lot of support for staying, for changing our current process. Have I not heard from someone who feels differently? Okay. So I think by doing nothing with that, we stay where we are. I'd like a motion to approve the revised call to go out for public comment.
What about the scoring scale?
Yeah, the scale.
We haven't talked about that.
Where is that in the call?
It's not actually in the call, but it's a discussion that matches up with all the rest of it.
Do we have to resolve it before we put the call out?
No, but we also didn't have to resolve the posted pre-hearing scoring decision.
Well, we're keeping it the same.
Does anyone want to change the scale that we are ranking the proposals on from the current 1 to 10 to 1 to 3, 1 to 5, 1 to 7? Is that the question that you're asking?
Bob, is it 0 to 10 or is 1 to 10?
It's 1 to 10. Currently, it is 1 to 10. That's what we've done. So 0 was a not. It's not what you're supposed to do. 1 is the lowest score.
I like 1 to 7.
I actually would like to second Jane's idea of the 1 to 7. I think it puts us, I always thought, am I thinking differently when I scale a 1 to 10? I don't know. This puts some numbers on it. I actually think it's kind of good to have a balance.
Okay.
The only thing I would say, I don't think this change, Mr. Chair, but the other thing we were thinking about doing, I think we would have needed to get input from the public on us making a huge change like that. But I think putting some values on the numbers, to me, makes sense.
Okay.
I don't care if it's 1 to 10 or... Yeah. I like the 1 to 7 right there. Number
1 to 7 lets you pick the middle easily.
And I want to point out that we're talking about comparing it to what you would expect. On a proposal of this sort, so it's an abstract mean you're comparing against, or an abstract average.
So there's 1 to 7 okay? No?
No, stay with 10.
Stay with 10?
Yeah. 10.
Sorry, I just got it. The reason, I really, really have a hard time with the whole scoring thing. I think it's screwed up, and the fact that nobody has ever said it's screwed up doesn't mean it's perfect. And there's room for improvement. The idea was to add some definitions to it, because one person's idea of 10 could be somebody else's idea of 7. And the definitions that were proposed, I think, give people a little better idea that 4 really is right in the middle. It's not great. It's not bad. It's okay. You know, 7 is a gangbuster score. I think if you don't have definitions wrapped around it, you have a bunch of meaningless fluff and extra numbers. If you want 10, that's fine, but I want everybody to understand and be given criteria of what a 10 means versus what an 8 means.
Can we agree on that? It would be helpful to establish criteria for whatever number system we come up with. Don't all go up on it.
All right.
Danny?
Mr. Chair, the thing I would add to that is I think the point's well made, because some people's total scores are completely different than somebody else's, or average scores, I should say, which they're definitely putting different values on. I don't think they totally think all the projects are crappy compared to one other person's thing. They're all good. They're using a different value system, which messes up our scoring. So I think we should agree on what a 7 or a 10 or whatever the number means, instead of somebody putting a 4 on it, thinking the same way as somebody putting an 8 on it.
Okay. For those of you that were in the 10 category, do you have a problem if we establish what each of these numbers mean and define that? Jim?
Well, let's take 1-4. It meets expectations. Well, define that. I mean, everyone's going to have a different definition of that, and in your point of view and how you look at it. I don't know how you... You're still going to have the variation, I think, that we have.
You're talking about, if I can paraphrase, this is really good, this is okay, or this sucks. And where on that scale does it fall? And you can define it different ways, but in essence, you're trying to, what I think Sue is trying to say is, can we agree on something that identifies what that is? Maybe it's not these words, but it's something that sort of says it's an exciting proposal, it's just an okay proposal, and it doesn't fit what I think we ought to do in this category.
Okay, Bob and Jim and Scott, you know, we only used 10 in the last 2 years. Before that, we used 5. I like 5 better than 10. I think it makes it a much more definable answer as to what you're putting on there. That's why I went to 7, because I thought it would placate you hardcore guys. I don't think 10 gets you anything better than a 7-point scale or a 5, because 5 gets you David's 3-point scale with a little bit of wiggle room in between all three of them. So, you know, the 10 isn't something we've been married to for a long time either. So defend your 10.
Let's not argue about 10 or 5 or 7.
All right.
Can we come to an agreement today that we will have a scale with some meaning defined on it, and we will work on that and determine that at the next meeting, and come up, I'll charge a couple of people to come up with recommendations that we can talk about going forward on that, and then we'll talk about that another time when we can see what 10 means.
Okay.
Is that all right with everyone?
Right. Yeah.
So I'd like to get the approval of the council subject to minor drafting edits to release the call to the public for comment. All right. And that is with the changes and adjustments we've made today. Correct, Scott?
Correct.
Any discussion? All, Sandy, call the roll. The roll. The roll.
Jane Kingston.
Yes.
Call the roll.
Sue Olson.
Yes.
Scott Rawl.
Yes.
Elizabeth Wilkins.
Yes.
Bob Anderson.
Yes.
Jim Cox.
No.
Sharon Hartwell.
Yes.
Senator Hampton.
Yes. Okay, it will be released. Jim, do you want to talk about why you voted no?
Well, number one, I haven't seen the final document. Number two, I still have some issues on that section two.
Okay. Any public comment? Thank you.
If I may thank the council, and specifically Jane Kingston, Sue Olson, Scott Rawl, for their small group work and help, and then staff at Heatherville. Thank you.
Thank you. And Sandy. Any public comments?
No.
Meeting is adjourned. Thank you all very much.